Hey, welcome to the Film Podcast. I'm Ricardo.
I'm Eric.
And this is episode 6 of our Canon film series, where we're kind of making our way through all the Canon films, discussing, you know, things we like about them, things we hate, interesting things. Just making our way down the list. It's been 6 episodes with this one, and I feel like we haven't put a dent in this list of movies. But we're back. We took a little hiatus. We're both kind of busy, both Eric and I, but we're back and we're ready to talk about, is it 5 more movies? Yeah,
sort of. So we'll get into that.
Yeah. So, first some news and then we'll get into which ones we're talking about. Eric, you want to talk about, should we talk about the documentary first?
Sure. Let's talk about the documentary. Yeah. So, the Electric Boogaloo, The Wild Untold Story of Canon Films, is making its way around the country, playing various festivals. I've yet to see anything solid about a general release as far as theaters or art house theaters go. But I know it just played at Wisconsin Film Festival in the last week. And the reports about it have been good. So people are enjoying it. There's been a little bit of controversy about the fact that in the film there's some things that said that are disparaging about Canon and about the people that ran Canon, but other people are saying, look, you know, they're trying to give you the whole story, and anytime you have something that's not even when you, I guess, do have a studio that's at the top level, that you're going to have problems and people that aren't happy. So, not having seen the documentary, I'm going to say that I want to hear the good and the bad from the people that were there.
I do too. Yeah. Here's the thing, that we're doing this podcast, this series on this podcast, because we love the movies here. Mm-hmm. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, but this is kind of what we grew up on, and I kind of want to hear as much as I can, because, I mean, up to this point, there wasn't a lot of, like, DVD special features on these, because they mostly had, well, all the ones I got my hands on were mostly just, like, literally the movie and the trailer, if that.
Yeah.
So you didn't have like the commentary from directors and stuff like that. But with this next announcement we're making is that a lot of these movies now are making their way onto Blu-ray with some pretty cool special features. And what's that company that's releasing them?
It's called Kino Lorber, and they're Kino Lorber Classics. And I think that they started off doing a lot of silent films and European films, but as of late, they've been putting out a number of Blu-rays of films from the Canon catalog. And a couple that that are of note are things like Avenging Force and Dangerously Close, and House of Long Shadows, I think is what's called, one that we couldn't do earlier because it wasn't available. That one's coming out. And a film we both really like, Last American Virgin, is finally getting a Blu-ray release from Kino Lorber. So, and I think they also are doing both of the King Solomon Mines and Alan Quarterman films, and there's just other stuff coming out from them. And then at the same time, of course, Shout Factory is picked up a few things. So it's a good time to be a fan of Canon stuff.
Yeah, and like I said, now with these Blu-rays, we're going to get a lot of like behind the scenes stuff, hopefully a little bit of, and mostly a lot of stories with the interviews with the actors and filmmakers and stuff. So, not only excited about the documentary, Electric Boogaloo, The Wild and Untold Story of Canon Films, but also all these great Blu-rays coming out. And I think at the end of the run, once we go through all the movies, we'll do a final episode where we talk about the movies that are now released and we couldn't get our hands on. Like, we'll definitely do some of the ones that are going to release, like House of Long Shadows and such.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, because that just seemed interesting to me because of the entire cast.
Well, you know, good or bad, it's something that I'd like to see and check out. So.
Yeah. So today, like we said, we're going to talk about, we're going to start off with Runaway Train, and then Matahari, and Death Wish 3, King Solomon's Mines. And that'll be it for this episode. We will save Invasion USA for the next episode, because the next episode's starting off with Delta Force, so that way we could do a Chuck Norris double feature kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I got ahead of the game, and I bought Delta Force, and can't wait to talk about that one, because I love it. I still love it. It holds up for me. But
yeah, I'll pull back the curtain and say I watched it as well, and I enjoyed it. So without going into too much about what I liked about it, I think it's worth checking out.
Yeah. And also, like, it's funny because some of these picks, I did, like, I would go through the list and be like, oh man, that's on Netflix. I'll just check it out since it's already on Netflix. And so I've been making my way through some of my favorites that I loved as a kid, like Over the Top. I rewatched. It was playing on TV, so I recorded it. But there's a ton of stuff that's playing either on TV or Netflix or HBO Go. But we'll talk about our first film, Runaway Train, directed by Andrei Konchalovsky. That's a mouthful. He is a Russian director. And let's see, Runaway Train is directed by Andre, and it was the screenplay by, I think he had his, oh, it's based on a screenplay by Kira Kurosawa.
Yeah.
Is this a remake?
No. My understanding is that this was a script that he had written and that Canon had purchased and then had some people readapt it. I think they were looking for that screen or that street credit of having worked with Kurosawa.
Yeah. And at this point, I'm drawing a blank here. The Cassavetes film, did we skip that already in the list? Or is it coming up? Love Streams.
No, we talked about it, I believe.
We did. And Love Streams, again, that was another movie that was hard to get, but we got our hands on it.
Yeah, well, but Criterion put it out.
Yeah, and just recently Criterion put it out. But like we said, Canon at this time was not only trying to, you know, they were trying to be successful in the action-adventure film business, but they also wanted, like you said, their street credit with, like, the great film, the I guess you would call the more serious directors like Kurosawa and Cassavetes and such, so...
Yeah, I guess what you would call the prestige films in their in their catalog. And if you go back to what was it, that championship season, that was definitely another attempt at something that was not necessarily going to be super commercial, but was going to be more of an artistic statement.
Yeah, yeah. And okay, so Runaway Train. Do you want to give the synopsis?
Sure.
Do it.
Story about a couple of cons that break out of a high security, very brutal prison, and they wind up on this train that is lost its engineer and is run away. I mean, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And it's on one level, it's a prison drama. On another level, it's an escape drama. On another level, it's people facing this finality of this runaway train that's eventually going to either derail or crash. So, and at the same time, you have this warden from the prison that is hell bent on getting back, especially the main prisoner played by John Voight.
Yeah. So, we'll go through some of the cast of characters and who plays them. John Voight plays Oscar Mannheim. Eric Roberts plays Buck McGee. Rebecca De Mornay plays Sarah. She's a conductor that gets trapped on the train with them.
Yeah.
And then who plays Warden Rankin is played by John P. Ryan,
who's a character actor that you may or may not recognize.
Yeah, he's amazing. And I like how in this movie, you know, before we get into it, I like the tone of the acting. It's a little melodramatic, to say the least. But I like it because everybody got on board. Because there's some movies that you watch that are from like the 80s, 70s that some actors got on board with the melodramatic acting, and some don't. And then now you're in a mismatched movie. But at least all the actors were on the same page. Hey, we're gonna do a little more acting on this movie.
Yeah, and can I just point out real quick, as far as really small roles in the film, you have Edward Bunker, who was most notably in Reservoir Dogs. He was an actual criminal who turned to writing while he was in prison and got involved with filmmaking once he got out. And this is also an early role from another former prisoner that we all know and love, Danny Trejo, has a small role.
This was his first like on-screen like appearance, I think.
Yeah, I think it was, if not his first, one of his first.
Yeah, and some of the stories that I read and stuff from this movie, the story goes that Danny Trejo was there with a friend, like he was like kind of like a PA kind of thing, mm-hmm. and Eddie Bunker saw him, and Eddie Bunker had done time with Danny Trejo.
They were
in the same prison. And he went up to the stunt coordinator and he said, "Hey, could we just give this guy a job? Like, could he not be a PA? Could we give him a little, you know, more pay?" And they said, "Yeah." And they said, "Hey, what could you do?" And he's like, "Well, you know, I boxed, you know, in prison." And mm-hmm. they're like, "All right, perfect. Well, we have this boxing scene. You'll be the opponent." And that's how he got on the movie. And a little trivia: Eddie Bunker, like you said, is a real life LA criminal that did some time for like bank robbery, all this stuff. But a little known fact is that John Voight played the character of Eddie Bunker in Heat. So if you remember Heat, he looks exactly like Eddie Bunker, like the hair, the mustache. So the character of Eddie Bunker makes an appearance in Heat, and he's played by John Voight.
Yeah, and I want to say he was Mr. Blue maybe in Reservoir Dogs.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So
and he just has that like look. Eddie Bunker, he was a decent actor, you know,
an interesting guy in general. I mean, yeah. I read one of his books. If you're into realistic crime novels, definitely check out one of his books.
Yeah. So let's get into it.
Alrighty.
This is a very interesting movie. I saw this. Now, was this your first viewing of it?
It actually was.
Okay. I remember watching this as a kid and thinking, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. They're on a fucking train and they're going full speed, you know, and just being mesmerized by like the fact that of how cold it looked, how cold mm-hmm. it felt. I hadn't seen it since I was like, you know, since it came out. I think I must have seen it in theaters, if not on VHS. But this movie, I rewatched again twice, and I really enjoyed it. Did you enjoy watching it?
I did. Okay. I did. We should say at the start here that this actually is on Netflix streaming if anybody wants to check it out.
Yes.
So
the movie starts off, and they're like in a prison, a maximum security prison that's in where. Do you know the exact location of the prison?
It's Alaska. I don't remember if they actually say the name of where exactly, but it's in Alaska, which of course is stark and barren and cold.
It almost feels like Siberia.
Definitely. This is hardcore prisons. Now, have you ever seen the film We're No Angels with Sean Penn and Robert De Niro?
Yes, yes.
Which is a remake of a classic, I think, with Bogart. That is set in Upper Michigan, where I visited many times because mm-hmm. my grandparents lived up there, in an area where there are prisons in Upper Michigan. And I had a little bit of that feeling of the cold and the ice and the kind of, you know, there's a stark beauty to this tundra that we see in Runaway Train. And on the opposite of that is, you know, Upper Michigan is beautiful. You know, it's forests and lakes and stuff. Yeah. But the idea that states would have these remote prisons that are in inhospitable landscapes totally, I think, works. And I think that's a great setting for a prison. I mean, where do we usually see prisons set in films? They're usually in deserts, or they're in tundras, or they're, you know, someplace remote and oppressive, or that's what I'm looking for. There's something about a good prison setting. You know, you usually don't see one that's set on a beach. Well,
no.
There's a special kind of film where you see those prisons.
Yeah, and usually they're an island.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah.
But so, yeah. Yeah, this is kind of an amazing looking prison. And the other thing I have to say is that it was kind of run down, and it's not like this high security, flashy prison or anything either. Mm-hmm. It's this well worn, you know, not comfortable, you know, hard ass prison.
Yeah. And actually, I pulled up the location. They filmed most of it in the rail yard scenes and some of the rail yard scenes in Montana. Okay. And then the prison is the old Montana prison.
Uh-huh.
But most of the snow stuff was filmed in Alaska.
All right.
So yeah, it's beautifully shot. It's easy to kind of just get it's easy to not make that look cinematic because it's so mm-hmm. much white, but it looks beautiful. It looks great. It holds up. And so the movie starts off and it's this desolate, isolated prison in the middle of nowhere. What we think is like Alaska. And these two guys, well, we first see the character of Buck, Eric Roberts' character. He's fighting and he mm-hmm. gets into some trouble, and he doesn't have much time left on his sentence. He could just wait it out. And but the character of Manny, he's got a long time, and he's had a couple of escapes. He's escaped a couple of times, and this is very clear that it's his last escape. Either he's going for broke, or he's gonna die trying. And Manny has this plan, of what he's doing, and I think Buck like really looks up to him, and for some weird reason, and really kind of wants to be his friend and be like almost mm-hmm. have him like a mentor. So he tags along on this prison escape. And I remember watching this as a kid and going, man, like saran wrap, I guess, works, to keep yourself warm. Because as they're escaping, it's going to be really cold and they don't have, thick clothes. Mm-hmm. So they grease up, right? Is that what they use? Like grease?
Yeah, they use some kind of grease.
And then they saran wrap their bodies, which is crazy. I'd never seen this in my life.
Well, if you think about it, that grease and that plastic are going to keep the heat in.
Yeah, yeah. But as a kid, like I thinking like, what the hell are they doing? Like what's going on here? And Manny takes off. He goes into this tunnel and the sewer tunnel mm-hmm. and takes off. And then we have Eric Roberts, he lubes up with the grease again, saran wraps himself, and he follows Manny down the tunnel. And it's pretty disgusting, what they have to go through.
Yep.
And finally, they're outside the prison, and they make their way to an old rail yard. And that's where they find clothes, and they jump on a train.
Yep.
Which they think... they just want to get out of the city, out of that little prison town. So they just hop on the first train that's leaving, and they get on, and they're on one of the carts in the back, and the conductor has a heart attack, right?
Yep.
So he kind of keels over, and he falls onto like the mechanism that makes it go faster, right? If I'm not
confused. The throttle.
The throttle, yeah, and. Now it's a full on. This is where the adventure begins.
Okay. Also, we should say that this isn't your typical train. This isn't an engine with a bunch of rail cars and a caboose. This is actually like four or five train engines that are linked together for transport.
Yeah.
There's not cargo. There's not passengers. There's nothing like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's on its own. In fact, they think at one point that they're the only ones on the train.
Yeah.
They soon find out so they think it's just them two, mm-hmm. And the conductor, and they soon find out that there is someone else on there, a girl. I don't remember. I'm trying to blank. Why was she on there? Was she supposed?
She
to
was.
Be
she was tired and taking a nap.
That's right. The old I fell asleep. And,
so can I just pause you here? And
yeah. Go.
Let's talk about something that struck me from this film, which is. This was made in 1985, okay, yeah. And based on a screenplay by Kurosawa. But let's talk about the lack of professionalism in every job in this film.
Yeah.
I've never seen so much porn in the workplace in a film.
Yeah.
If it's at the prison or it's at the rail yard, Rebecca De Mornay is asleep on the train on her job. the warden is overzealous. I mean, you've seen the original Bad Lieutenant with Harvey Keitel.
Yes, yes.
I watched it the first time when I was on cable back and right after it came out, and I was with one of my best friends, and he turned to me and he said, "The reason this guy's a bad lieutenant is because he's never doing his job." And this film, like, the cons are the only ones that are really doing their jobs.
Yes,
they're being cons. Everyone else is from the prison staff who aren't either paying attention or overzealous, to the railroad staff who are working when they shouldn't be because of their health issues, or sleeping on one of the train cars,
yeah.
Or like I said, never seen so much porn in the workplace in any film, or the secretary that's refusing to do her job and all that stuff.
Yes, had porn just come out? Because everyone in this movie is looking at Playboy or
whatever. Yeah,
yeah.
I think it's more that maybe it's that they're in this remote, area, and there's not a lot of social contact, and the rules tend to get a little bit lax when.
Yeah,
the bosses aren't hanging over you, and you're kind of left to your own devices, really.
Yeah, and the way Buck helps Manny get into the sewer system plant that's in the prison by putting him. Eric Roberts hides John Voight in the dirty laundry.
Yeah,
and the way, because the guard checks all the laundry, he pokes mm-hmm. around, but the way he gets around is awesome. By the way, the guard playing the elevator, because he has to go through on this elevator to get down to the first floor, then walk out, and then they go into this boiler room. Well, the guard on this elevator is played by Tommy Lister, who is. I was like, is this the guy from Friday? He plays who's he playing Friday? He plays a really gigantic guy.
Zeus? Is that the character's name?
Yeah, I think
it's been a long time since I've seen Friday. But
he plays a giant man who punches out people, and then Smokey says, "You got knocked the fuck out." He plays Zeus. Yeah, I pulled it up. And then he's also in Universal Soldiers. He's in a bunch of movies. Great character actor.
He's one of those tough guy character actor types.
And the way he gets around Tommy Lister's character is that he gets his son – is it boxing shoes, right?
Some kind of shoes.
Yeah, sort of sports shoe. And he's like, I don't – but by the way, I don't know how Eric Roberts' character gets these boxing shoes that are brand new, by the way, into a prison that's in the middle of nowhere.
It's the same way that Red gets the rock hammer in Shawshank Redemption. The prison kind of commissary trading thing has its own logic.
Yeah, yeah, but it's like you think man, it would take a long time to get boxing shoes all the way up to the prison, middle of nowhere, and then it just but it works for the movie. Okay, so take it from there. So they get everybody's not doing their job. We have Rebecca De Mornay taking a nap on one of the train cards. And so once the train takes off, they're in there. And correct me if I'm wrong, but don't they kill somebody at the rail yard?
I don't know if they kill somebody or somebody dies by accident.
Yeah, yeah. But it's – I think they – yeah, somebody might die by accident, but – the point is that they figure out that they're there because they see their old clothes that they took off, because they get new clothes at the rail station, and they hop on the train and they take off and on this runaway train, and this is where it starts getting crazy and amazing and over the top and awesome. So you have Warden Rankin chasing him, who's played by John P. Ryan, who's a great character actor. Is he the guy from Rambo as well? Is he in First Blood?
No. I don't remember. Let me pull it up.
He's an Avenging Force. I know that.
Okay. Character actor, obviously. Let me just hit kind of the high points of films he was in.
Yeah.
Five Easy Pieces, King of Marvin Gardens, Future World, Postman Always Rings Twice, 1981, The Right Stuff, Cotton Club, yes, he was an avenging force, and he will be coming up again in Death Wish 4. Oh. He was in, let's see, Class of 1999, which I saw recently and is amazing.
Yeah.
Looks like his last film was a little gem called Bound from 1996, if anybody remembers that. Something makes me think that the guys that made that film, you know, had a big career, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, yeah. The Wachowskis.
Yes.
Bound, oh man, that's so cool. I think he plays the main, like, mob boss in Bound, if I remember correctly. But yeah, this guy plays the warden who's after them. And he'll stop at nothing to get them. I mean, he's horrible at his job, but he'll stop at nothing.
Yeah. I mean, when I say he's horrible at his job, he's overzealous is the word.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not that he's being lazy or, you know, not being thorough. It's that he's at the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to take it from here?
Well, basically, you know, then they're on the train and it's you know, heading towards its final destination, and it actually comes more like a three-person play,
yeah,
in a lot of ways. The dynamic between the three characters as they try to slow the train down, to stop it. You know, there's other characters that are the railroad employees that are trying to keep it on track with, you know, they're switching tracks so that it's not going to go through curves or over bridges that can't take the high speed and that kind of stuff. So it, in some ways, it's about a bunch of characters that are trying to stop the inevitable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the film, I noticed that a lot of the Canon films and a lot of the directors that they had hired before this movie were really kind of doing, like, you didn't see very, like, innovative shots, meaning everything was on a tripod, everything was very simple. Mm-hmm. And this, I noticed there was a lot of handheld stuff, you know, a lot of almost like documentary style, you know.
Yeah.
Very cinema verite, and it was a very different look to what Canon had done before in their previous films. So that really interested me, of how they really kind of went out of the box to make this movie.
Well, and additionally, the motif of this train that is a runaway train also gives it a certain certain energy and a certain velocity.
Yeah.
that you don't get with films that are just statically shot. You know,
yeah.
If you're cutting between dialogue that's sometimes tense and emotional but not overly so.
Yeah.
To scenes of this train just hurling down the track, you know, it kind of makes that connection between heightened emotion and the speed of this train.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I wonder if, like, Tony Scott watched this movie before he did Unstoppable, because I mean, there really hadn't been a lot of, like, runaway train movies, you know, like, there are very few movies,
yeah,
that take place on trains, period.
Well, you know, I was speaking of runaway train films, the one that I was going to bring up is the one from a year or two ago, Snowpiercer.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, yeah, there's, yeah.
You know, you have this train that's hurtling along the track, and you have this cold, foreboding, apocalyptic wasteland outside in both films.
Yes, yes. And as much as I did like Snowpiercer, there's nothing like the reality of actually filming. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that, like, look, really cold location. Like if they would have really done it and filmed, like, in Alaska or something, at least, mm-hmm, the exteriors, it would have been a much better movie for me. Like, it just would have worked so much better. The CGI takes away so much away,
yeah,
from the movie that
it, well, it's too perfect, because here it's not that everything's, like, white and frozen. You see trees and dirt and,
yeah,
you know, muddy, rutted roads and all the rest of it that you would really see in those locations.
Yeah, yeah. So very soon they find out, both Eric Robert and John Voight's character find out that something's wrong, because the train's going way too fast. It's not right. And they move up to the next train cart, and they soon find out, they discover, Sarah, who's played by Rebecca De Mornay's character, is on the train as well. And she's this was early on in her career. She's got really short hair. She kind of looks like a tomboy, a little bit tomboyish. And she works for the rail yard. You don't know really what her job is. She's not an engineer or anything. She's just a general worker on this.
We get a little bit of background on each of the main characters, but not a whole lot. Yeah. We don't necessarily hear their whole life story, and we get bits and pieces, but nothing. We get the kind of stuff that would naturally come up in conversation with people that you're around or in a situation with.
And I like that about this movie, that you don't really, because you don't need to know that stuff. All you need to know is that these three people are trapped on this runaway train, period. And like you said, it becomes almost like a play, on a moving train. Mm-hmm. And it cuts away a very few times, mostly to like the warden and to the guy, I guess he's not an engineer, the guy that...
The controller for the train or for the rail system.
Yeah. Who's always put off by everything. Yeah. He's like, oh man, like
Well, and he's brought in this fancy computer system and everyone's giving him a hard time about it.
And so they find her and she tells them there's something wrong. Like, we shouldn't be going this fast, or something wrong. So one of them's gotta go out there and figure this thing out. And I think Eric Roberts tries to go out first, and then eventually I think they all make it out there, out to the front cart, and it's very difficult because it's a really old train, and they finally get up front. They see that he's dead, and they can't slow it down. Like something's awry with the train, and they can't slow it down, so they can't get off of it. They can't jump off, and at this point, the warden has figured out where they're at, and he's on a helicopter chasing them down. And it's really interesting how, he doesn't send, a SWAT team after them or anything. He's like, F this. I'm going down there myself. I got to stop this train. And he doesn't really want to stop them. He just wants to kill them, period.
Yeah, and especially the John Voight character. It's become personal.
Yeah, and they have a little history. Like, he's escaped a couple of times prior to this. And
once again, that unprofessionalism of you're in charge. You should be delegating these tasks. You should be bringing in help. You should be, all that kind of stuff. Nope. I guess you would say he goes off the reservation.
Yeah. So he just ties a rope around his waist and just jumps out of the helicopter. Yep. literally. And so... it becomes this basically, like you said, this three-person play, and then them being chased by the warden. And like we said in the beginning of this, there's a lot of overacting in this.
Yeah.
Eric Roberts is like breaking, he does the Pope of Greenwich Village after this, I think. And right before this, maybe. I'll pull this up.
Well, while you're pulling that up, let me say about the acting that John Voight was nominated for Best Actor for this. Eric Roberts was nominated for Best Supporting Actor at the Academy Awards. And noted film critic Janet Maslin of the New York Times thought the film was absurd, but she did single out Voight's performance. I'm reading this off Wikipedia if anybody wants to look it up.
Yeah.
That she said his performance was excellent, and she credits it for the film's crude energy and bravado. So while it is scenery chewing, overacting, it is to a purpose. Yeah. It serves the story.
Yeah, yeah.
And it serves the film.
Yeah, and I will say Rebecca De Mornay's acting, it wasn't too much over the top. Mm-hmm. It was mostly the convicts and the warden that were all, even the controller, the train controller, he was kind of subdued, but everyone was in the same movie. That's the point, that the director clearly had a vision of where the actors could go and not go. And I did like the fact that it was kind of like these two caged animals, and they were kind of were over the top, but it worked, like you said. It and served its purpose.
If you think about the situation, you have a prison break, you have a runaway train. These are situations in which people's emotions are going to be heightened. Their adrenaline's going to be pumping. They're going to be yelling and screaming. And, you know, they're nobody – if somebody's really laid back and not worried, you should be worried about that person. So even though the situation is kind of absurd, it does fit the situation.
Yeah, yeah. And soon enough, Eric Roberts' character figures out that Manny is no friend of his. Like, I mean, since the beginning, like, he's – all he wants is Manny's like friendship almost, like just his attention. And he doesn't get it at all throughout the movie. And in fact, like at one point he's going to beat him to death, you know?
Yep.
And Rebecca De Mornay stops Manny from killing Eric Roberts' character, Buck. And then they become kind of like a team, like kind of like us. They want to survive, you know, Eric Roberts and Rebecca De Mornay's characters. And, John Voight is hell-bent on, like, not going back. He's going to either, you know, escape or, like we said, he's gonna die trying. Mm-hmm. And at this point, like, the warden has jumped off the helicopter with literally a rope around his waist. Mm-hmm. And he's gotten on the train. And John Voight's character has disarmed him and has handcuffed him to the cart, to the engine.
Yeah.
And so they aren't going anywhere. And now they know, they've discovered that pretty soon it's going to get derailed. The train will mm-hmm. get derailed, and there's no way to stop it. There's no way to slow it down. They're just screwed. And Eric Roberts' character and so Buck and Sarah move to the back cart, and John Voight does something. He does something really cool, and he saves them. After almost killing Eric Roberts, he decides to save him, and he goes and he unhinges the engine from the rest of the train.
Yep.
Which could have been a thing they could have done in the middle of the fucking movie.
Well, you know, I can say this from experience. When you're in the middle of dealing with a situation, sometimes you don't think about the most obvious thing until like 20 minutes later.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it happens to me at work a lot these days. It's like, oh, why didn't we do that at the beginning? So, but, you know, then again, you know, you have the simple solution. You don't have a story.
Yeah, yeah. And so he undoes the clasp thing. And while he's doing that, his hand slips and his hand gets Manny's, John Voight's character's hand gets stuck and it gets crushed and he loses his hand.
Yeah,
And it's blood everywhere, and he wraps it up, and he unhinges the train cart, and it separates, and like, you know, Buck is like yelling at Manny, and he's crying, and he's overacting, and he's you know, he's got snot in his face, and you know, tears, and it works, man. Like I still don't understand what he saw in Manny's character, what Buck saw in Manny's character. Why did he look up to him? I still don't understand, but that's something that I don't really need to know. Like, hey, this guy wanted to follow this guy on a escape plan, and it turned out to be the wrong guy to follow because that guy didn't care about him. And so the character Bucky and Sarah are left on the train, and it's slowing down. And then the engine continues with the warden and Manny. And Manny decides to get on top of the train, and then he just stands up and he kind of just rides it till the end, you know, and you don't
Slim Pickens riding the bomb down at the end of Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, yeah, like that style, but
that even howling at the world while you go out.
Yeah,
you
know, and
top of the world, Ma.
And with that freezing cold air, you know, hitting him, and it's pretty cool, and you see the train, you know, come to an end, and it's beautifully shot. I'll say that, like, it was really well done, and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the second viewing of this movie, and
it was interesting to see it for the first time. Considering the reputation this film has, it's often cited as the best film that Cannon ever made.
Yeah,
the critical reception was pretty significant. You know, Roger Ebert gave it 4 out of 4 stars. Michael Phillips from At the Movies has said it's the most underrated film of the 1980s. It's got an 86% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes. So when we're talking about Cannon films, usually we're very upfront about the fact that these These are often enjoyable B films. They're not supposed to be high art, or, you know, they're supposed to be crowd pleasers, not critic pleasers. But to see that this film was able to be a crowd pleaser because it was very successful and a critic pleaser is really interesting.
Yeah, yeah, and the poster and the cover for this movie is like really interesting. It's really well done. It's simple. It's just a train coming through glass, yeah, and the characters' faces on the top.
Well, and it conveys that energy, yeah, that movement, that velocity,
and this unstoppable train, you know, like just breaking through glass. But I will say, like, by far, like, I mean, nostalgia is a motherfucker, because I understand, like, I talked about in the last episode about how much I love American Ninja. But that's all nostalgia. You know, like, that's all me at the right time, at the right place, at the right age. But genuinely, I can probably say that this is probably the film I most enjoyed again. Okay. Just because it's like you said, it's for the time and for the company and for what they were doing. It was really well made. And it's really underrated. And it's sometimes hard to get people to watch this movie because they're like, what is it? It's Eric Roberts and John Voight. I don't know. It's really hard to get people into it. But it's one that I definitely recommend. Again, it's on Netflix streaming. So check it out. Give it, you know, give it. I always say give it a try. Give it 10, 15 minutes. If it's not your cup of tea, it's fine. But at least give it a chance.
It's definitely become a cult film, too.
Yes. So
I hear people talk about it. I see people talk about it.
Yeah.
So
there should be a Runaway Train shirt.
I'm sure there will be. So I have a quick question for you before we go into rating this.
Shoot.
Eric Roberts' character is named
Buck.
What's his?
Buck McGee.
All right. This was kind of his, you know, he was nominated for an Academy Award, so this was a breakout role for him.
Yeah.
John Voight won an Academy Award playing a character named
I don't remember. Oh, did he win
Joe
for this?
Buck.
Joe Buck.
From
That's
Midnight
right.
Cowboy.
And it was way before this. Yeah, you're right. Oh, man.
And he's kind of the young, innocent guy that goes to New York and he hooks up with Ratso Rizzo, who is this, you know, hardened, sleazy street character who kind of knows what's going on. So I'm wondering if there is kind of that dynamic with John Voight's now the world-weary, you know, con.
Yeah.
And he takes, you know, he winds up with this young, fairly innocent, you know, guy, you know, Buck under his wing. And the other thing is that, you know, in Midnight Cowboy, he's moving to New York to become a male hustler, you know, which is obviously, you know, a sex crime. And we find out that Eric Roberts' character is in prison for statutory rape.
Yes, yes, yeah.
So I just kind of put that together. And
I didn't see that. That's pretty interesting that you saw that. I totally forgot about John Voight winning Oscar for Midnight Cowboy. Wow. And you're totally, totally right. And the characters kind of fit. Like he kind of looks up to this character, mm-hmm, who doesn't really necessarily likes him, but at the end really kind of loves him because at the end he saves him. You know, he saves Buck.
And at, you know, all right. So the end of this film is one of the characters dying and Buck surviving.
Yeah.
And Midnight Cowboy is they're on a bus. And it's the character named Joe Buck who survives.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, I don't even know if there was a conscious homage or thought there, but.
But it's interesting. You know. If it's not, it's an interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask you before we're going to get into the rating here in a minute. Did this film remind you at all of The Gray?
It did. It did. Just how like. It's definitely like one of the, it's a dude's movie, you know, like it'd be hard to get a lot of these movies. I'll definitely be honest and go, oh, this is, you know, I'll tell you who the audience was, you know, but this is definitely like a dude's movie like The Gray was. And it has that feel of like really cold elements and like, you know, even in The Gray, they're like wrapped up in whatever they could find.
Yeah.
And this is how this is. And yeah, you're right. You're right. Now that you pointed out, it has a lot of similarities, you know?
And they both have this kind of existential dealing with death and movement and, you know, this cold, harsh world and survive or not survive and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a question about, like, man back in nature, in his in the elements. And you're right. You're right. And I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but I fucking love the gray.
I know really, you do. And that's why I asked you about it.
I love the gray. It just kind of, I don't know. I have this interesting, I like stories that show how, you know, I mean, not so much now, but before it was hard to like be like, dude, you're my best friend. And like how dudes connect. Do you know what I mean? Like, how guys bond and connect because of the world we live in, you know, like it's not really acceptable sometimes. You look like you don't want your friend to call you like pansy, you know, like so.
Let's be honest here, and to my gay friends out there, I love you all. You don't want to be called a fag.
Yes, at least
when I was growing up, that was the thing.
Yeah, yeah. And there you go. Exactly, and we mean no disrespect to anybody. But
so the other film, really quick, that I wanted to tie this into was Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah. Oh. Totally.
I mean, it's you know, the gray, Cool Hand Luke, Runaway Train, all deal with, you know, man versus the inevitable, man and freedom and movement and going forward in the cold, harsh world and all of those kinds of things.
And again, Cool Hand Luke is another movie about how men interact.
Yes, it is.
You know, within friendships, within groups. And I totally see that, man. Good. Look at you, man. Damn you.
I have those insights. So,
Okay. So our Runaway Train letterbox rating. Again, we put everything on letterbox. You can make a movie diary if you want. It's free right now. Mm-hmm. It's a social media website for people who love film, and you could find us on there. I'm under Ricardo Latrez. I think you're under
Iron Zero. You know, just hit us up on the Facebook page for the film podcast if you want to, you know where we are on Letterboxd.
Our Letterboxd links are on our website at the film podcast. If you go to the gang and you go to Eric's page or mine, our Letterboxd links are on there. So if you want to follow us or, you know, you want us to follow you. But what did you give this rating? You can go a star to 5 stars.
Okay. I gave it 3.5 stars. I really liked it a lot. This was my first watch, and if I watch it again, it may go up. But that was just my gut initial reaction to it.
Yep, I gave it 4 stars. I gave it 3.5.
Same ballpark there.
Yeah, I gave it 3.5 a while back when I rewatched it, and then I rewatched it again, and I'm like, you know what, I got to give it 4. But there you go. That is my Letterboxd rating. 4 stars.
We both
stars.
Definitely recommend this one.
Yeah, we definitely, like we said, it's streaming on Netflix. Check it out if you get a chance. Just give it a try.
And you know, if you liked any of those films we talked about, Cool Hand Luke, Snowpiercer, The Gray, this should be right up your alley.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll say this: it's not a movie a lot of women are gonna like, but I mean, this easily, I like Rebecca De Mornay's character. I think she's real. And she's playing out the circumstances in a realistic way, and she's amazing in this.
Well, she's also not a sex object.
No, at all. Yeah.
I mean, let's face the fact, she was one of the most beautiful women on film in the 80s, and you know, they don't turn her into a Barbie doll or anything like this. Now,
in fact, she looks dirty and grimy, like she's got grease on her face, and
film does not pass the Bechdel test for a simple reason that I don't think there's a single shot where you have two women together. So that would be the only reason it doesn't.
Well, I think there's only two women in the movie: the train controller's secretary and Sarah.
So. Yep, that's it.
They're both well-written characters, because they could have easily gone, you know, off the rails with this or made her like a sex object and stuff. But no, she's a real realistic looking character. And but I don't think it's a movie that the ladies are gonna like. You know.
Yeah. Well, You never know. Some will, but if you're interested in film, you will.
Yeah.
If you're looking for, you know, something fun and light, this isn't it.
Yeah, yeah. So like we said, Eric, 3.5 stars. I gave it 4 stars. And is that it? Any final thoughts?
Nope. Another I think notes? We're ready to move on.
Done. Our next film is a movie that Eric's going to talk about.
Okay.
And I have some questions. It's called Mata Hari.
Okay. I'm just going to be up front and say, remember when we covered Bolero and I called it Borlero?
Yes.
Yeah, I call this Borlero 2.
Wow. This Electric Boogaloo?
Yeah, no. It doesn't even deserve that. Ostensibly, this is a famous World War I spy story that was actually, I believe, there was a version of it made back, I want to say, in the 30s that obviously would not have been as racy as this. But it's really an excuse to get Sylvia Kristel, who was a Dutch actress known for the Emmanuel films, get her clothes off a lot. There's a lot of, you know, playing, you know, like softcore in this, basically. And
this is a remake of a 1931 film.
Yes.
With Greta Garbo, right?
I think it's the Garbo.
Yeah.
There's no Roger Ebert review of this. So this was so dull, I forgot to take notes on the first half of the film. I mean, really, it's got nice furniture. There's interesting clothing because of the era it's set in. There's one battle scene that looks pretty cheap that's supposed to be World War I. You know, this is like Skinemax fare. And it's not worth anybody's time, unfortunately.
I wonder why they produced this movie. Was it the titillating value? Like just to get, you know, the teenagers in there to see this?
Well, as bad as Borlero was, I mean, it made money.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, you get one of the, you know, sex icons of the era take her clothes off a lot, and you get a film. And I think that's what happened with this. And I bet you they made a lot of money of this playing drive-ins and on Skinemax and, you know, European showings or whatever.
Yeah.
But I just can't recommend this to anyone. I just was bored to tears. I barely remember it. There's really not a lot to say. I mean, yeah, that's it. Like, it's 1 star.
1 star. Yeah, that's generous because you could have gotten half.
You know, I give it 1 star because it had interesting clothes and interesting, a couple of interesting things. And as I always say, if you kept the boom mic out of the frame and the light, you know, it's well lit and the production design is okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, it – because – I save those half star and no star ones for things that are just incompetent in addition to being awful.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
It's funny. I know a lot of friends of mine, and you know, they're really harsh on some movies, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I say this, and usually the people who are the most harsh on the critique of film, or especially things that are like not dramatic or not prestigious enough, like, you know, an action movie or something. They're really hard on things because, and I say this all the time, I say, I used to have a really harsh opinion on movies, and then I started making them,
mm-hmm.
and then my critique of them started to get a little lax because it's so easy to mess up a movie. It's mm-hmm. the hardest thing to make a good movie. It's so many things have to go right in order for you to make a good movie, and it's so easy for them to go wrong, you know? And I think it would be interesting to see, to just have every critic and stuff just go out and make a short film, like a 5-minute short film, and just see how hard it is to make something good, you know?
You know, I always remember Roger Ebert's line about his understanding, because he actually made films.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually involved in the process of, he wrote, you know, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and, you know, he was in documentaries. So he kind of got that, but he always, it was either him or Gene Siskel that always said, You know, I asked myself, would I be more interested in seeing a documentary about the making of this film than this film?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And I it's easy to say, well, that action film wasn't as well done as that great drama, but they're two different animals.
Yeah.
You know, and I always say the worst thing you can do is bore an audience.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly. But I like your critique all the time because you're pretty fair. Like you said, you could have given Matsuhari a half a star, but you gave it one star, and that says a lot about you.
I just remember my fourth grade teacher and her book report formula. You give a synopsis, which I guess I didn't really do. Let me see what we got here for a synopsis. Based loosely on the real life story of World War I spy, and the exotic dancer uses her contacts in Europe, European high society, along with her seductive charm, to collect military secrets during the war. She successfully plays both sides against each other until at last her deception catches up with her, which I didn't get any of from the film. But at any rate, my teacher always said, you give a synopsis. You tell us what it's about. It's about a spy, World War I. You say what you liked. Oh, a lot of naked chicks. I'm okay with that. I like the set design. It was well lit. You know, some of it looked good. What didn't you like? It was boring. It looked cheap. I couldn't follow what was going on. How long is this thing? At 104 minutes, it's probably longer than it needs to be. And then whether you recommend it or not, no, I can't recommend this.
Yeah, yeah.
Bottom line. So, you know, that's what I always try to remember especially when I'm trying to give a review of something that I didn't like. I'm so tired of the it sucked or I didn't get it or, you know, I couldn't follow it kind of reviews when instead of saying, you know, it just didn't connect with me, I was bored, it looked terrible, whatever. I mean, people, we need to have a better language for critiquing things than it sucked or my least favorite these days is meh. I don't want to hear your meh. I want you to tell me why it was
yeah,
meh.
Yeah. My new thing is also like when we're reviewing movies is if I have nothing nice to say, I won't review the movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like if I can't find one thing, I'd just be like, I'll pass. Why waste like my time in either writing or saying a review of a movie, mm-hmm. talking about a review of a movie that is negative because it's like, well, I didn't even like it. Why am I wasting my time? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I like something about it, I'll talk about it. Like, hey, I didn't like this, but you know, like that.
Well, I hope we gave enough information to people that are curious about it. Yeah. And I did get it via disc from Netflix, which I no longer have that. I'm no longer getting discs from Netflix. But if anybody really, really wants to check it out, it's there.
Yeah, yeah. And like we said, when we started the podcast, like literally today, I was thinking, it seems like I've seen this movie, but I was wrong. The one I had seen was the original, the old Greta Garbo one. Because everything you were describing was like, oh, that seems like similar to what mm-hmm. I remember. But yeah, it's different. I'm sure it's a very different movie.
As lovely as Sylvia Crystal was, she's no Greta Garbo.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so on to our next movie, which is from 1985. It is Death Wish 3.
And can we just pause here and say that the dates that we've been following are from Wikipedia, and recently the release dates on the Wikipedia pages have changed.
Yeah, yeah.
And so some things have been moved around, and so we're trying our best to work with that.
Yeah, yeah. So sometimes they're a little off. We may be an episode or two off, but we're pretty much in the same year.
Yeah,
the months may be off, but we're the years are staying the same.
And we're also trying to catch up with films that are sometimes difficult to find, or that we just, you know, like you weren't able to get to Matsuhari, which is fine because I don't recommend it. But you know, there's films that I can just talk about and, you know, not give great reviews to that we don't really need to come back to. But there's other films in here that, you know, we've passed over that neither of us have seen or that one of us has seen and the other one needs to see it because we would like to talk about it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
So like we said, Invasion USA we'll talk about next episode when we do Delta Force. But we'll talk about 1985's Death Wish 3. And that's Death Wish 3 with like the number 3, not Roman numeral. And the reason is a little story before we get into it. They wanted to know, Menachem Golan wanted to know whether that was confusing or not. The Roman numeral 3. So he quickly like had these guys do like a poll about the you know, just pull people around the U.S. to see, you know, so they would cold call people. And they quickly realized that like 50% of the people they called didn't know, couldn't read Roman numerals. So they went away from the Roman numerals and they went with the actual number three. So it actually would look cool if it was a Roman numeral three, I think. And
yeah.
I like that about movies. But Death Wish number three. directed by Michael Winner. And this is the third film in the series that he directed. He started off in the, you know, with Death Wish 1, 2, and 3. This was his last movie. Charles Bronson and him kind of had a falling out. Apparently, he went off and shot gorier stuff, like as B-roll, and put it in the movie. And Charles Bronson didn't like that, and kind of that ended their relationship. This is also the last movie to not have a subtitle. Like, the next two have, like the next one is, like, Death Wish 4, the assassination or something like that.
I think it's L.A. Takedown.
L.A. Takedown. And Part 5 also has that subtitle. But this was the last movie to just be Death Wish and number. And again, so to catch you up, Death Wish 1 wasn't produced by Canon Films. That was, they bought the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
So they started with the producing Death Wish 2,
which we did review previously.
Yeah. So check that out if you want to know what we thought of Death Wish 2. But so Death Wish 1 started off in New York with Paul Kersey as the vigilante, avenging his wife's murder and his daughter's rape. And then 2, we saw him going to L.A.
Yeah,
where he met up with is it Mario Van Peebles that's in that? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think he's the bad guy in that one.
Yeah, and he did it with evildoers there. And Part 3, he's coming back to New York. He's coming back to Brooklyn after years of being away, and he's going to visit his old Korean War friend Charlie,
his old army buddy.
Yeah,
although he was he was a conscious objector, so he never was in the war. Yeah. So I guess it's his old buddy somehow.
Yeah. That's how the movie starts off. It's Paul coming back into town to visit his friend. And, when he gets to the, by the way, I didn't know this. And most of this movie was shot in England. Only the beginning and some of the, a very few exteriors were shot in New York, but everything else was shot in England. I didn't know that. That's pretty crazy.
Interesting.
No wonder, like, throughout the middle of the movie, there aren't any, like, landmarks that you could see or, you know, or identifiable landmarks of New York. Paul comes to New York again, and he's going to go visit his friend. And as he's arriving, his friend has a break into his apartment. By the way, the friend lives in the worst neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And it's gang ridden. It's just this gang is like terrorizing the whole neighborhood, and the cops won't do anything about it. And so they break into his friend Charlie's apartment, and they want money. They want like protection money. And Charlie wants nothing to do with that. He's not going to give them any more money. He's done. And so they beat the crap out of him. And one of the guys that beats him up is this character named Hermosa, played by Alex Winter. A really
Bill
really,
and Ted fame, right?
Yeah, really, really young Alex Winter. Yeah. Is he? He's Ted. Is he Bill or Ted?
He is.
Oh man.
Yeah. Now I'm losing all of my 80s high school cred. He's Bill.
He's Bill.
Bill S. Preston Esquire.
Oh, that's right. Alex Winter is one of the thugs. And there's another thug called the Giggler. That's his only name. And
who's a callback to a character from Death Wish 2.
Yeah. And he's always giggling as he runs. Like he's throughout the whole movie, he's a purse snatcher. And he snatches purses and he just giggles his way home, I guess. So anyway, these guys are beating the crap out of Charlie, and Charlie's neighbors call the police and say there's a scuffle upstairs. You guys got to get here quick. And just as the evildoers, the gang, is leaving, Paul, Charles Bronson character, shows up, goes to Charlie's apartment, finds him like beat up on the floor. And just to hear Charlie say his last words, he just makes it barely on time. And Charlie says, "Take care of my stuff until I come back." And he dies. And just as he dies and he's all bloody and beat up, the cops show up conveniently. Yep. And they blame Paul Kersey for killing this man. And so they take him in and they rough him up in prison, in jail. And the prisoners rough him up too. And that's where he meets what's the villain's name? The main villain who has the reverse mohawk. I think his name is Gavin. The character's name is
Manny Fraker.
Fraker, yeah. And this guy's haircut is crazy.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a reverse mohawk.
It is the epitome of. Somebody thought this would be scary, but now it looks like a cartoon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he literally has a reverse mohawk, which is the mohawk is the shaved head on the sides mm-hmm. with the spikes in the middle. And he has long, like, schoolboy hair on the sides and bald in the middle.
Yeah, just a shaved stripe in the middle.
Yeah, which is crazy. Which does give him an interesting look. I'll give him that. So Fraker meets Paul in jail, and they don't like each other from the beginning. And, and Fraker leaves, and he tells Paul, "If you want to find me, come to this neighborhood," and gives him the neighborhood. Turns out that's the neighborhood where Charlie died. So anyway, the police inspector, police inspector Richard Schreiker, played by Ed Lautner, character actor, who you've seen in a ton of stuff. I like this guy. It's funny because he's always looked that age.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right? I mean, he died 2 years ago.
Yeah, and I believe that one of his last films was The Artist. Yeah, he had a small role in The Artist.
Yeah, he did. He did The Artist, and he was also in, I watch a Showtime show called Shameless.
Mm-hmm.
He was in that, and he was great, and he was in The Office, and he did two more roles after The Artist, but those were his last roles, and like I said, he looked that age all his life. I felt like he always looked old.
Yeah, he's one of those character actors that's been in all kinds of stuff. Yeah. You will recognize him.
Yeah, he's that guy, you know? And I like him. Ed Lautner, is just a great, solid actor. I like him and everything he's done. And so the inspector says, "Hey, I know," he tells Charles Bronson. He's like, "Kersey, I know who you are. I know you were the vigilante, and then I know that all of a sudden you moved to LA and all these people started dying, and then now you're back." And he's like, I can't, my guys, my detectives, my patrolmen can't get things done. Like, you know, like he basically says, "I need you to come. It's open season for you, you know, come and let us get some busts. So help us, you know, get some good press, but you know, go nuts." He gives them the green light, you know? And that's all Paul Kersey needs, man. You know, he gets his.
That's just the setup.
And then the evildoers have their days counted. You know, and I just saw this movie this morning, and it was fun. Like Death Wish 2 wasn't too. It wasn't fun for me, but this one was fun. It's like maybe because it's over the top. That's
yeah, and for me. It's become probably the most cult of the mainstream cult of all of the canon films. There's a lot of canon films that have a cult following.
Yeah.
The Apple has a cult following. You know, Life Force has a cult following.
Yeah.
This is largely because of things like the AV Club giving it like this cool cult midnight status. You know, a new generation of people have discovered this film as a ridiculous, you know, go to a midnight film and laugh at it with everyone else kind of a film.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I don't like that. I don't like laughing at movies. I mean, yeah, some of them are they're laughable, and yeah, there's some things to laugh about, but this movie was it's not that bad. It's actually like for an 80s movie, it's decent. It's got some good action. Mm-hmm. It's got, I mean, there's some plot points that don't make any sense, but it is better than a lot of the fare that was coming out of the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I would never go see this movie to go make fun of it. I'd actually like to see like a film print of this. It would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and then so Paul goes back to the neighborhood and moves into Charlie's apartment because the rent's paid up for the month.
Yep.
And he just goes nuts on all the evildoers. And he kind of has, he develops this relationship with the like the DA.
Which I'm sorry is like one of the most ridiculous aspects of this film,
and a plot point that you didn't need at all.
Yeah, no, it was a oh, he, you know, he needs to have a romantic whatever because that's what we did in the last one. And the last one, his romantic lead was his real life wife, Jill Ireland. So I mean, that kind of made sense, and it, you know, it was still in at least number two, he was still trying to get back on track with a normal life. And this, he's like totally, you know, his life is now about killing bad guys. So they didn't need that at all.
Yeah, totally. And like, you literally could have like taken that part of the story out and saved like good 10 minutes.
Yeah, and
the story would have been a lot smoother. Like the story would have unfolded a lot faster and a lot smoother. But anyway, he's dating her, and the evil the gangs finds out. Fracker finds out. And they knock her out. It's the weirdest death.
Yes, it is.
How they kill her is, Fracker goes to the store. I don't know what he's getting. I forgot what he's getting. But he leaves her in the car, and the window is down. So Fracker and the gang, they creep up and they knock her over the head.
Yep.
And so she passes out, and then one of the guys goes into the car and releases a brake, and they just push the car because it's downhill. Paul just happened to find the one liquor store that was parked.
I think he was picking up his mail.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. He's picking up his packages from his PO box.
Because that's what you do on a date.
Yeah. Hold on. I'm so close to my PO box. Let me just stop and get my damn mail. And this is right after he had slept with her, by the way.
Yeah.
And so they release a brake, and then the car rolls down, and it crashes into another car, and it just spontaneously combusts.
It's one of them cars made out of flash paper.
Yeah. But then that pushes Paul over the edge, man. And at one point, they think he killed this woman, and so they're holding him at the prison, but the inspector helps him get out, mm-hmm. and he just goes nuts because at this point they've killed the lady he's kind of interested in.
Mm-hmm.
They beat up all the neighbors that are, by the way, I don't know why they're all elderly people.
Well, and elderly minorities. People and the Cuban couple, I guess, or the Hispanic couple. They're all good, decent people.
Yeah. And so all the elderly people are getting beat up,
yeah,
and getting their purses snatched.
Purse snatching. It's a crime of the past, largely, but
yeah,
it was a real thing at the time. And
it still
is now. But.
It makes sense, you know. And the big thing is that the Cuban couple, the wife gets raped, and that really was one of the things that, and they kind of like they don't show it in the movie, but I don't know how her arm gets broken. I don't know how, but they get to the, Paul calls the hospital and they say, oh, she's fine. You know, well, I mean, as fine as she can be after she got raped, but, mm-hmm. but you know, all she has is her arm's broken, and, you know, come in and pick her up. And so him and the lady's husband go to pick her up from the hospital, and they get there and they're like, she's dead, man. I'm like, what? And Paul's like, I literally just called. What's going on here? And he's like, well, she must have had a blood vessel, like something wrong. And well,
there's a major artery in your arm.
Yeah. And he's like, what's that?
Go ahead. I was saying, did you happen to notice who played the wife?
No, who was that?
I just looked it up. So it was Marina Sirtis, who, of course, her next role was Star Trek's Next Generation.
Oh, wow.
That is interesting. This is the film she made right before that.
That is nuts.
It is. I'm like, how did I not notice that?
I didn't notice that either, and I literally watched it today. So yeah, so she's dead, and so Paul's over the edge, man. Yes. And so at this point, Charlie's friend, another elderly guy, played by Martin Balsam, who's another character actor. By the way, I'll say this about Canon Film Groups. Always cast great character actors.
Oh yeah,
always. This Martin Balsam, I've seen him in a ton of movies, and he always gave me this like Ernest Borgnine kind of vibe.
Yeah,
like he was like the poor. I can't even say poor man's, because Martin was a good actor, man. He passed away in the mid 90s, but he was a really, really good actor, and I can't say he's a poor man's Ernest Borgnine, because he was just as good as Ernest Borgnine. We'll eventually talk about more of his work when we get to Delta Force next episode. But I really like this guy. But anyway, Martin Balsam's character Bennett is also a veteran, and he's got a bunch of weapons in his fucking apartment. And this is where it goes. It turns into a full on urban war.
Okay, he just doesn't have just weapons. He's got military machine guns. I'm not talking assault rifles here. I'm talking machine guns from like World War II era.
Yeah.
I mean, these are combat weapons.
Yeah. And so the gang gets called in, and then Fracker calls in even more like other gangs to come and just tear shit up. And Paul and all the neighbors go F it, and all of a sudden they're all armed. They're all armed to the teeth, and they just go, it's full on urban warfare, and it's the gang versus the neighborhood versus the police. And then the inspector shows up, and he's helping. It's funny because I noticed that his character's the inspector, and it makes sense since they filmed it in London. It makes sense that they called him the inspector.
Well, actually, not to get too technical, but New York Police Department does have a classification that is inspector.
Really?
At any rate.
Well, anyway, this makes sense because this is New York. So
yeah.
And so they go on to the last 30 minutes of the movie is just people getting blown up, people getting shot in various ways, Charles Bronson just getting scratched here or there, but he survives this massacre, and the people help him, they fight with him, the inspector shows up and he's helping him, and at the end, my favorite death is I don't know what kind of gun the Cuban guy has, but it's like a pipe gun.
It's a zip gun.
Yeah,
what they're called.
It's crazy. I had never seen that before. So they've kind of killed the whole gang, and there's only a couple of them left, but they haven't gotten Fracker. So they go to Paul goes to his apartment, and he's trying to reload another gun because he's out of ammunition. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Fracker shows up, and he's behind him, and he's about to shoot him. And bam, the inspector shoots Fracker. And then Fracker's on the floor, and they're all kind of like, oh, man, that was close. And the inspector got shot as Fracker, fell to the floor. He fucking shot at him. And so they're kind of all injured. They're kind of, getting themselves together. Paul's calling an ambulance, and all of a sudden, Fracker gets up. He's wearing a bulletproof vest. That's what you always shoot in the head, man.
Double tap, man. Double tap to the head.
Yes. If this guy's a nefarious character, you gotta shoot him in the head. You can't. What if you can't?
Like a zombie.
Yeah. So he's like, one of you's gonna die, you know. And they're both like, well, you can't shoot us both, you know. And all of a sudden, I don't know how Fracker doesn't just shoot Charles Bronson, because Charles Bronson takes forever to reach over, pull a bazooka, a rocket launcher, out of his apartment, and he shoots Fracker, and the whole side of the apartment just blows up.
Yep.
And Fracker just goes flying out. I don't know how he's in one piece still, because all the gang sees him on the floor, and they kind of like give up, and they just kind of run away because they see Fracker on the floor. But a weapon that blows away half the building, I mean, you have to imagine that his body would have just been in shreds. But yeah. No, it's in one piece. It's a little burnt. But the gang gives up, and the inspector says, well, the police are after you. I'll buy you some time. Get out of town. And so again, Paul Kersey grabs his stuff, grabs his coat, grabs his bag, and he walks out of town. And my favorite thing is as he's walking out of town, and everyone's looking for him, by the way, the police car just drives right by him.
Oh, yeah.
They don't question that. Eh, just a guy with a bunch of guns in a bag. It's all right. And the movie ends, and again, Paul Kersey survives, does away with all the gang, and the neighborhood is once again safe. I love this. Again, it's fun. It was. I love part one because it's so serious. But
yeah.
this is a fun action movie, and it's a little over the top. Yeah, but the acting is great. Like this, the acting by the gang is a little over the top. But Charles Bronson always kind of, I like how he kind of just played it straight. You know, like just hey,
yeah,
I'm just shooting.
Well, he knows what to do in this kind of a role.
Yeah, yeah, and. I have to say, I think at this point of his life, I think he was 63 or 64 when he made this movie.
He was in his mid-60s.
Yeah, so that's incredible. I mean, what we have in Liam Neeson is like mm-hmm. our Charles Bronson. You know, like how old is Liam Neeson? Like in his like
probably
50s,
in his, right? Got to be in his 60s.
You think so? Yeah, probably late 50s, early 60s. But yeah, this is exactly what the parts of the, eventually we'll look back at, like, you know, Taken 3, and that'll be our Death Wish 3, you know, in the future.
Well, I haven't seen Taken 3 yet, so.
I haven't either.
I don't know. I saw the first one. Two was
horrible. Two was horrible. But back to Death Wish 3.
Yeah, okay.
That'd be interesting if Liam Neeson did two more. Just like Death Wish, he just did two more, and the next two had subtitles. You know, like that. I'd actually be down for that because it would literally be like the Death Wish series.
It should be Taken for Proof of Life or something. Yeah, like that. Yeah.
But yeah, again, this is a fun movie. Kind of sexist. Kind of a lot of tropes. You know.
Yeah, well, it's ridiculous and over the top, yeah. And you know, there's a certain amount of weapons porn going on.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
There's a lot of weapons being used that are not appropriate for the setting.
Totally, you know, totally.
Machine guns and rocket launchers and hunting handguns and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and it's cartoony. It's over the top. It's all of those things. And I think it's enjoyable on a couple of different levels.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of, it gives us, I mean, even though it was shot in London, but it kind of gives us a little glimpse of what New York was in the 80s. It was pretty dangerous, and there was a lot of purse snatchers, and, you know, there's probably a lot of rape going on, you know? Like, there's a lot of criminals in New York in the 80s. Yeah, it was a fun action movie. And Charles Bronson knows what he's in. He knows how to deliver the lines. He's great. This is the Charles Bronson everybody remembers. You know, like,
oh yeah,
he made some great movies in the beginning. Look, I love Once Upon a Time in the West. I love it. I love his early work. But this is what people are when you talk to somebody about Charles Bronson, this is what they remember.
Yeah,
you know,
they think Death Wish, and while they might be thinking they saying the first film, they're really talking about. The 80s Death Wish films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, all right. Should we get into the rating?
Sure. Go ahead.
I gave this, let me see, Death Wish. I don't know what I gave the other ones, but this one I'm going to give 3 stars to. I'm going to be generous and give it 3 stars.
I give it 3.5. So, we're kind of in sync, a little bit different. I, you know, it was fun. It was pacey. I think it probably could have lost that romantic interest angle, and you know, played a little bit up a little bit more of something else. But yeah, no, it's this is recommend, and it's a 3.5-star film.
Yeah, yeah. What did I give it? Did I give it 3?
You said 3.
Yeah. Yeah, right in the middle. I really enjoyed it. It's not like something like, here's the thing, Runaway Train, I'll probably eventually watch in a couple of years. I'll probably watch it again if it's on TV. But Death Wish 3, as fun as it was, I mean, it's fun to have in the back, you know, when you're watching during a party or something in the background. But it's a movie that's a great action movie that I'll probably recommend, better than 2. I enjoyed this way better than 2. But I don't think I'll ever like sit down and watch it again.
Yeah, a film like Runaway Train has other levels that you can look at it on, as we discussed. Yeah. This is all surface.
Yeah, yeah.
There's really not, you know, and I will say this about Death Wish 1 and 2, that there was a certain amount of subtext in those films about the crime issues in those cities in that era.
Yeah.
So this is really, this is all surface. This is all pop vigilantism.
Yeah. Basic. And part one was definitely, like you said, it was saying something about crime. It was saying something about being helpless. It was saying a lot of things. And and one is definitely like to me, a prestigious film that I actually like. That's a movie that I would, if I was teaching a class in film, I would definitely put that in there. You know, like it's one of those great ones. And probably some of Charles Bronson's best acting too, you know, besides like Once Upon a Time in the West. But these are more actiony and stuff, and it's kind of like how I feel about the Rambo series. Like one is like a writing one class. It says something. It's genuinely saying something about like the Vietnam War. It's saying something about this outsider. It's saying something about loneliness. It's saying something about not having a community or family to come back to, where the sequels were just pop action, you know?
Yeah.
That's how I feel about this series as well. But again, 3 stars for me, 3.5 from you. And I think that's your final thoughts. So,
yep. Alrighty.
On to our last film, right?
Of the series. King Solomon's Mines.
I didn't get a chance to see it, but you did. Give us
I'm gonna read the Letterboxd synopsis. Yeah. Fortune hunter Alan Quarterman teams up with a resourceful woman to help her find her missing father in the lost wilds of the 1900s. That would be like, you know, between 1900 and 1910.
Yeah.
Africa, while being pursued by hostile tribes and a rival German explorer. If that sounds at all familiar, it's because this is a major cash-in on the whole Raiders of the Lost Ark, Romancing the Stone adventure story. So Alan Quarterman was actually one of the characters created by H.R. Rider, who probably most famous these days for Alan Quarterman having been used in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the comic, and I guess the film where he was portrayed by Sean Connery. I haven't seen that film, but it doesn't have a good reputation. So the other thing to be said about this is that it does play it to a certain kind of not spoof or parody, but it definitely is trying to be fun and funny. And let me turn the page here of my notebook. All right. H. Rider Haggar's book is based on Richard Chamberlain and Sharon Stone's Star. It's pacey. It moves along. It's silly. It's got some stupidity in it. It's, you know, it's fun, bright background entertainment. It's not Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's not Romancing the Stone.
Do you know the rating on this? Is it R or PG-13?
I do not know the rating offhand, and I want to say that it was probably PG at the time. No, it was PG-13, I guess. Okay. So
no Sharon Stone boobs. That's what you're saying.
Well, you can find those other places.
Yeah.
But yeah. Is it? You know, I don't know that. All right. So very quickly. You know, I got like 2/3 of a page of notes, and it doesn't go too long between action scenes. There's a weird cannibal sequence that's kind of strange for the way it plays out. Like I said, they play it for laughs, and I kind of question of whether or not it would have worked better if they had played it straight. I did note that Sharon Stone's shorts kept getting shorter. And
as the movie went on, they got shorter.
Yeah, and I also did note that I think she got sexier when she got a little bit older. You know, I don't think she was all that great as like the young hot ingenue. I think she was definitely projected a sexier image once she got to like Total Recall and obviously yeah. Basic Instinct and that kind of stuff. It was more of a confidence to her acting. This, she's still young and fresh and just, yeah, I don't know. There's something missing from her. And Richard Chamberlain's fine, but you know, he's kind of goofy, which I guess is fine. I'm going to give this 2.5 stars right in the middle.
Nice.
It's not anything that anybody needs to run out and see right away. But if you're looking for something mindless to kind of put on in the background at a party or, you know, hang out with friends drinking beer, this, you could do a lot worse than this.
And it also stars John Rhys Davies, right?
Yes, I believe. Yes, he's in here slumming it from, you know, you got to have somebody from Raiders, right?
Yeah, yeah. So. One of the smaller characters, right? And it's directed by J. Lee Thompson, who also did Tense at Midnight with Charles Bronson. We talked about in a previous episode. He did The Ambassador. He did this, and then he did Firewalker, which we'll talk about. Death Wish 4, which it's will be the follow-up to Death Wish 3. The Crackdown. I think that's it. But he worked quite a bit with Canon Films.
He was one of their in-house producer types.
So you said, how many stars did you say again?
I gave it 2.5.
2.5.
It wasn't awful. It wasn't totally awful, but it wasn't super great either. I mean, it was fun. And if you're looking for kind of a tongue-in-cheek, something that knows that it's supposed to be a silly adventure film and that kind of thing, you know, it's fine.
And in 2004, they did a TV movie. I don't know if it was a follow-up to or a remake, a straight remake to this. I'm sure because since it's based on a book, I'm sure it's
Yeah, just well, those characters are in the public domain at this point. So
they did another King Solomon's Mine with Patrick Swayze as Alan Quarter.
Yeah. Well, I do believe that there was actually a sequel to this. That was in 1987 that was Alan Quarterman and the Lost City of Gold. And according to Wikipedia, these films were made back to back.
Oh, really?
So yeah, I have yet to see it, but it's got Henry Silva in it, who's a great character actor, and it's got Elvira herself, Cassandra Peterson, and James Earl Jones. So that kind of gives me a little hope that it's going to be a lot more fun, maybe. Yeah.
And I'll definitely check that one out.
I think these are both coming out as a. On a Blu-ray from Kino Lorber.
Okay.
It's like a 2-pack. Let me check that really quick because I know this is great podcasting.
And so this one was in 85, and then the next one eventually came out in 87, like you said. And it's will probably be maybe like two episodes or three till we get to that one. But we'll definitely be covering that one as well. King Solomon's Mines. Also, are there any like straight ripoffs from like literally from like Raiders? Are there any like key scenes that are like very reminiscent of Raiders at all?
Not that I remembered.
Okay. The next one looks very much like a Raiders type cover.
Yeah, I mean they both were, but I think from what I've heard that the second one's maybe more fun.
Yeah. So that is our last movie of this episode. And then on the next episode, we'll do another 4 or 5 movies. Like we said, we're definitely going to do Invasion USA and the Delta Force.
Yeah.
And then we'll see what else we get into for the next episode. We might end up with a Stallone movie, Cobra. But yeah, we'll do about five movies for the next one. And stay tuned. You could follow us on the podcast at thefilmpodcast.com. And that has all our links. You could find us on Twitter at thefilmpodcast. You could find me on Twitter at Ricardo, ULTRERES. Eric, where could they find you on Twitter? Are you still on Twitter?
Yes, I am. I'm at Iron Zero, which is IRENZERO. And I've actually been using Twitter lately. I've been tweeting album covers. Just nice. Random record album covers that are, to me, visually striking. So
yeah,
check that out. And I also recently, for our friend Brian Sauer, did a his current series is Overlooked Gems of 1985, and I wrote one of those for his blog series. So a bunch of that stuff got tweeted and whatnot. So you can go ahead and take a look for that if you're interested in what I thought from 1985 people need to look back at.
Nice. And where else can people follow you? What other podcasts are you on?
The main podcast I've been doing is the Love That Album podcast with Morris. And I actually just recorded a episode where I am the guest, but usually on the main episodes, I do a 10-minute segment called An Album I Love. And then the other thing that I've been doing for, I don't know how long now, since sometime last year, is doing a short, like 20 to 30 minute podcast talking about a compilation album or a couple of compilation albums that are usually tied together. In fact, as we're recording this today at the beginning of April, the newest of my compilation editions about a couple of power pop compilations just got released. So
nice.
I try to make them 20 to 30 minutes so that people could listen to them on their commute. And yeah, you can go check them out.
Excellent. And like you said, this is episode 6. We've got quite a way to go to get to the end of the films, but they're getting good. They're getting more.
Yeah.
They're getting fun. They're, you know, we're going to eventually get to the stuff that everyone remembers. You know, like Masters of the Universe. We're going to talk a little bit of Over the Top, Bloodsport. It's getting fun, guys. So stick with us. I think the ones that are really hard to watch are behind us. And I mean, except for Matsuhari. So, but besides that, stick with us. We got a lot coming, and hope you enjoyed. So until next time, hey, have a good week.